Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
To quote my favorite philosopher, Yogi Berra, if you don't know where you're going, you'll end up someplace else. Well, let me tell you, as of tonight, we know where we're going and we know how to get there.
Eliot Spitzer invoking Yogi as he accepted the Democratic nomination for governor last night, which he won with a cool 81% of the vote. Senator Clinton also won renomination with more than 80%, but she didn't give a victory speech. Later this morning, we'll have the Republican gubernatorial nominee, John Faso, to begin his campaign against Eliot Spitzer right here. And we'll hear from Democratic presidential hopeful Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, who's considered very much a front runner at this point. But right now, let's debrief some of these primaries, local and national, with Village Voice columnist Wayne Barrett and Christian Science Monitor congressional reporter Gail Chaddock. Wayne, Gail, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, thank you.
Wayne, I want to contrast a clip from Spitzer's victory speech and Cuomo's victory speech, Andrew Cuomo. These are just sound bites, but they do represent the tone of each speech last night. Spitzer first.
This will not be upstate versus downstate, urban versus rural, business versus labor, Republican versus Democrat. To realize the reform that we seek, it will take every single New Yorker, no matter what you look like, where you came from, or what you believe in, working together towards a common good and a common purpose. We will not let the two Georges add insult to injury. We will not replace Eliot Spitzer with their hand-picked candidate, Jeanine Pirro, period.
Well, the two Georges there being Bush and Pataki. So, Wayne, one was a wee bit more partisan than the other. Are they not on the same page for the fall campaign?
The first of many times, I think, if both of them get elected. I think Andrew Cuomo and Eliot Spitzer are fated to have a very difficult time with one another. Just look at the fact that a local 1199, the Hospital Workers Union, was the bulwark of the Cuomo campaign, and if Eliot Spitzer is going to achieve anything in Albany, he has got to take on the Medicaid costs that are just burdening the state in such an overwhelming way. So I think they're on a collision course, and I think you do detect a very different feeling about November. This 81% that Eliot Spitzer rolled up is just really extraordinary because Tom Suozzi is a legitimate candidate. I mean, we're not talking about a non-entity here. And so I think the feeling around the state, Eliot Spitzer is perfectly positioned to talk the way he just talked in that soundbite. He could come in with the biggest mandate of any governor in our lifetime.
Gail, control of Congress is at stake this fall, of course. Did anything happen yesterday around the country that might affect that balance?
There was a very important race in Rhode Island, you know, small state that hasn't had a race this fiercely contested in anybody's memory. Lots of national money poured in. And the question was whether incumbent Republican Lincoln Chafee could maintain his seat against a very strong rival who was much more closely aligned with the Republican base.
Much more conservative, really much more supportive of the president and the National Party. Funny enough, though, the National Party funneled a lot of support to Lincoln Chafee because Rhode Island is seen as so liberal at this point that it would not have elected the conservative Republican. It would have almost certainly elected a Democrat, and that seat would have changed hands. So you get the irony in this race, I guess, of the Bush folks being behind one of their biggest opponents from within their own party, Lincoln Chafee.
That was the odd thing about that race. If you did a blind taste test and just asked each candidate how they supported National Party positions, Stephen Laffey, mayor of Cranston, would certainly have won. But there is such concern at the national level about holding on to a majority in the Senate that the National Party will back anyone who they think can do that.
So is there any reason to think that Rhode Island is a bellwether for anything other than Rhode Island around the nation, or is it just the, you know, the very upper west side?
No, I think it could be a bellwether in one sense. People are watching very closely what happens next. Will the Republican base that supported Steve Laffey, including the Club for Growth and all the social conservatives behind them, will they actually be engaged in the national race, or will they be so turned off by the fact that the party is sending, you know, in states like Rhode Island, moderates, that the seat will nonetheless be lost? Lincoln Chafee isn't home free yet. He faces a very strong competitor on the Democratic side. And this is—it's going to be a very tough race yet.
And so even if Lincoln Chafee votes with the Democrats on some issues, it makes a difference if there's an actual Democrat in that seat, because obviously, if there are 51 Democrats, then they would vote for a Democratic majority leader and all of that. Let me go back to New York on this point. And Wayne Barrett, speaking of senators and speaking of victory speeches. You know, I was here until 11:30 last night anchoring primary returns. And as the winners were announced, Elliot Spitzer gave a victory speech. Andrew Cuomo gave a victory speech. Yvette Clark gave a victory speech. But Hillary Clinton, no victory speech. Why so humble?
Well, you know, this Jonathan Tessini candidacy, I think 17% is a respectable number. I think it was some indication that she really does have problems, you know, with her war position, even in her home base where she's beloved. I mean, she's been an excellent senator. Most New Yorkers know that. She has an extraordinary track record here in the state. So a 17% vote is clearly about one issue and one issue alone. And it's not just that she voted for the war. It's that, you know, it was very rarely raised. I was kind of disappointed that Tessini really didn't raise it. She didn't just vote for the war. She voted against all the Democratic alternative resolutions that Carl Levin and Richard Durbin introduced, where her colleague, for example, Chuck Schumer, voted for 2 out of 3 of those resolutions. So her position on the war is really a problematic position that many Democrats have with her, and at least, you know, 17% voted that way. She doesn't want to draw any attention to that, so no victory speech, not even here, no party, and I think she just wanted to pretend it didn't happen. Well, it did happen.
Wayne, maybe the most interesting thing to talk about in New York is the 11th Congressional District in Brooklyn, and Councilwoman Yvette Clark wins that wild race to succeed Congressman Major Owens. How'd she do it ultimately?
I spent the day in the 11th CD, and I was at her headquarters. I was at all the headquarters, and she had just an enormous field operation, really enormous. It was totally union manned. I looked at the board that they have in the storefront operation, and usually when you go and you look at the board, you see the names of individuals covering various polling sites. I could only see the names of 5 individuals on her board. It was all 1199 at this site, 32BJ at this site, the Painters Union at this site. It was a really union-run campaign.
Turnout.
Right, and a very effective one. It was an extraordinary campaign because it was 4 very competitive candidates, and I think the most important thing from the standpoint of people in Brooklyn, and I live in the 11th CD, is that a stake has been driven through the heart of the Clarence Norman organization. Clarence Norman's already been convicted twice, the former Brooklyn County leader, and Carl Andrews was his right-hand man. So Carl Andrews' defeat, I think, ends in a, is a very important thing in Brooklyn. It ends an era.
Interesting. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we debrief some of yesterday's primary results and what they mean with Wayne Barrett from the Village Voice and Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, one race decided only a short time ago this morning. Ben Cardin defeats former NAACP chair Kwesi Afume for the Democratic U.S. Senate nomination in Maryland. And the outgoing senator, Paul Sarbanes, is a Democrat. The Republican candidate in that race is African-American. So we almost had a situation where both candidates were black. But how does that race shape up with Cardin as the victor?
Well, I think you're going to see a very competitive race in Maryland. This is a race that the Republican National Committee is determined to win. They will put lots and lots of money into it. It's part of a campaign to demonstrate that there are viable black candidates in the Republican Party, something that hasn't been luminously clear in the past. And one thing I think that's going to be very important, and you just mentioned it in connection with the New York race, is turnout. This was a decisive issue in Rhode Island. That's why the polls were so all over the map. No one knew how many people would turn out. The record in that state ever was about 45,000 in a primary back in 1964. And Lincoln Chafee said to me on the road just over the weekend, if we can get above 45,000, I can win this. I will win this. The turnout in Rhode Island was 70,000. Now, how did it get up that fast, that high? The Republican National Committee sent in their fabled 72-hour turnout squad, very targeted database. Now, there was a lot of discussion in the state about how effective this actually would be, but the numbers that finally showed out to vote in that race and the gap between the candidates suggested that it may be more powerful than people have thought. That will be a factor in every race in the country.
Indeed. And interesting, this race indicates why it would be much easier, maybe much easier, for the Democrats to take control of the House this fall than to take back the Senate.
Good point.
There are more districts where the incumbent or the outgoing senator is a Democrat, where that's a contested seat. And Maryland, as you were describing, is a perfect example.
But, here's another just footnote on that story. The Republican National Committee has said today they are going to throw every dime they have, $80 million into House and Senate races. Howard Dean at the DNC is not committing to anything like that.
Why?
Because there is a real dispute here. It's very complicated as to whether or not some needs to be saved for the presidential race, whether it really is possible to take back the House, should they shoot their entire wad on this. And even a more curious argument, there are Democratic strategists that think it might even be a bad idea to take back the House now.
Why?
Because it could sink a presidential candidate. Any Democratic House would be thwarted, everything they did would be vetoed. Mm. They could talk a lot, but they couldn't accomplish very much. So the Republican candidate in 2008 says, look what Democrats promised, look what they could actually deliver, nothing. There's an answer to that, but not one that can easily be made in 8 seconds.
Well, coming up in 2 minutes, we will speak with one of those Democratic presidential hopefuls, former Virginia Governor Mark Warner. Wayne Barrett, we do just have about a minute left. You had an article in The Voice last week that got a lot of people talking about something questionable from Andrew Cuomo's past. It didn't affect the outcome of the election, obviously, but very briefly, summarize your reporting and tell us if you think it will be a factor as he runs against Jeanine Pirro.
I certainly expect that Jeanine Pirro will make some use of the issues that I raised there. The issues go really to a character decision. Andrew Cuomo, when he was the Secretary of HUD, had very substantial interactions with a company called Insignia that was then owned by Andrew Farkas, who became not only Andrew Cuomo's employer and paid him $1.2 million, but also raised and contributed $800,000 to his campaign. I call him the $2 million man. The problem really was that Andrew Farkas was managing projects at HUD and managing them horribly. And
Cuomo went after him, and then Cuomo went to work for him.
Right, and he reached a settlement with him. I just think the appearance of Cuomo establishing that kind of a relationship with a guy that his office reached a settlement with, that his counsel signed, this is a disturbing appearance.
We have to leave it there. Obviously, Pirro also with a lot of questions.
She sure does.
To answer, Wayne Barrett from The Voice, Gail Chadwick from The Monitor, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Democratic
Thank you.
Presidential hopeful Mark Warner in a minute. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.